anything. It really doesn't matter. Look, I was born in the city, and I was educated in the nice little Sunday school. We've had a lot of noise tonight. I have to ask one favor, and that's the newspaper people. Please leave. Okay? So if you want to take a picture of me, then go ahead, but then you got to leave. All right? Thank you. There's a very important reason why I asked you to leave. Because I've traveled around the world and I've seen problems that Jewish people have that don't get discussed in national magazines and in newspapers and all around the world. It's a very private little club we have to learn about the Jewish problems in the world. And you're never going to see it in print what I'm going to tell you tonight, and it doesn't go outside this room. You tell it to your friends, but it doesn't get published anywhere. And you're never going to see it published anywhere. But first, before I go into what I really want to talk about, I just want to give you a little bit more background of myself besides the other bullshit about where I go to school and everything, which really doesn't matter. Look, I was born in the city, and I was educated in the nice little Sunday schools that we had, and I went to Hebrew school and all of that, and it really didn't mean very much to me. I came away from that, being bar mitzvah and everything, not really feeling very much like a Jew. To me, it was a very dirty word. But you see, we Jews in this world, we really don't have a choice of whether or not we want to be Jewish. Because when I walk outside of my house, when I was a little kid, like 3 or 4 years old, the little kids down the street that used to call me Dirty Jew or Kike or Jew Bear or any of that crap, they didn't bother asking me whether I felt Jewish or not. They knew I was born a Jew, and therefore I'm a Jew. I asked newspaper people to leave, and I asked for a reason, so I'd appreciate if you'd leave. Okay, thank you. So therefore, what I'm saying is that even though when I was younger, I did not feel Jewish, I was told I was a Jew. And this is a very, very confusing thing to me when I was little. And as years progressed, when I was around 17 years old, about 3 years ago, I went afternoon, I was over at somebody's house, and they're having this guy from Israel come to speak. And he was going to talk about 20 Jewish adults or so and tell them what the problems in Israel were and the problems of Jewish people throughout the world and how only Jewish people helped other Jewish people. Nobody else helped the Jewish people. And that one little day, I learned an awful lot. I learned that there were Jews in Iron Curtain countries and communist countries who had to be brought to freedom. And I learned that the Jewish state, Israel, was in desperate need of money and aid, and nobody was doing it except the Jews in this country and Jews in the world. And I got so pissed off that day that my Sunday school and the nice little rabbis and all those people didn't do a damn thing to educate me as to really what's going on with Jews in this world. So I went out by myself and I found out. You met Milton Feinberg tonight. I want to tell you something about Milton Feinberg. He's one of the finest people that lives in this city. I went to him and I said, look, like, I heard this guy speak about Israel. I know you're executive director of the Federation. And tell me more. Tell me what's really going on. So we sat for hours and hours, week after week, and he just told me, he kept lecturing me, telling me what was going on. And that led to my going on a trip about 2 years ago to some Eastern European countries, and some European countries into Israel. And that's really what I want to talk about, the things that I've learned, the things that I've seen. The very first thing that you've got to understand is that Jewish people have a history of about 4,000 or 5,000 years. And 30 years ago, there was this crazy thing called the Holocaust, this super nightmare, where 6 million Jews were murdered. And you've got to understand. You've got to understand that 30 years out of 4,000 years of Jewish history is like a needle in a haystack. It's nothing. And I was in Munich, where the rise of the Nazi regime began, and I walked the streets where Hitler walked, and I sat in the beer garden where Hitler stood up on tables and made his rabble-rousing speeches. And I stood at the square where Hitler reviewed his truth. But worst of all, I went to Dachau concentration camp. I went to a death factory. with a guy named Herb Friedman, who was on General Eisenhower's committee to liberate the concentration camp. And he showed us slides of the day that the camp was liberated. Because you go there today, and it's like a nice, beautiful national park. The lawns are all trimmed very nicely. The buildings are painted every year. They have a nice, pretty museum. The floors are waxed, the whole bit. But 30 years ago, Jews were murdered there. They were murdered only because the only crime was that they were Jewish. That was their crime. And I stood in that camp, and I closed my eyes, and I imagined what the hell it was like. And it's a nightmare. I don't know how people that lived through that period made it. I just don't know how the survivors make it today. I don't know how they can live. But you better never forget it. It happened, and it's happening today. The same goddamn thing is happening today. In 1967, after the Six-Day War, Nasser said all Jewish males go to jail. And I met a kid in France 19 months ago who had gotten out of Egypt 2 weeks before I got there. And I sat and I talked to this 22-year-old kid who lived in a village outside of Cairo, and like he was very assimilated. He didn't feel Jewish. He didn't feel anything towards Israel. He was the only Jew in the community, the only Jew that went to that college that he went to, everything. Didn't feel Jewish at all. Didn't feel for Israel at all. Nothing. But 1967, Nasser says, all Jewish males go to jail. Damn it, he went too. And he was there for 2 years, about a year and a half. And for the first 6 months that he was there, he was in a room, I dare say, half the size of this room with 60 people, and one bathroom, and he was beaten twice a day, and he had one meal a day, a Spanish rice. And it happens today. There's Jews still in Egypt. There's Jews in Syria today. There's Jews in Iraq. There's Jews in Lebanon and Jordan, all those countries, and they're all being screwed up. They're all getting beaten. Jews in Iraq live in a Jewish quarter. Bank accounts are frozen. If a guy dies in Syria, he can't leave his money to his children. It's got to go to the state, which in turn turns it over to Al-Fatah, which in turn kills Jewish children. With Jewish money, they're even doing it. That's how fucking low they are. And I don't like it. And what I want to tell you is that we can't sit back anymore. The time has passed. The little meek Jew, the little, you know, meek Jew that walks around with the pay, I think it's out. We're not in that image anymore. We're very strong people. But there's more. It's not just in the Muslim countries. You read every day about this new thing with Russian Jewry. What is this whole Russian Jewry thing? I met a girl a week ago Thursday, and it was one of the most touching moments of my life. She got out of Russia in November. 2 weeks ago, she came over to this country from Israel. When she left Russia, what happens there is you apply for an exit visa. And maybe, just maybe, you get it. About 2,000 or so get it a year. Out of 3.5 million Jews that want to leave, a couple thousand trickle out every year. And she applied for an exit visa, and she got it. But she got it 2 weeks after she got married. Now you think about it for a minute. You think about it, if you were in a country, and you married somebody, and you really loved them, and you had an opportunity to leave or not, whether you would leave. And if you leave, the implications of that is that country stinks. When I talk about oppression in Russia, I don't mean it's not quite as blatant as what happened during the Nazi period, where they just murdered thousands of Jews and millions of Jews. I mean, what happens there is while the kids are like in high school and under, when they're young kids, they're taught gung-ho communist party. Everything was gung-ho communist. She didn't even know she was a Jew. And then when she went to fight at college, when she was 18 years old, they said to her, well, look, you know, now you're a Jewish girl, so you've got to get grades far superior to everybody else so you can get into college. She said, well, now what's this on the Jew business? Well, you're a Jew, you're born of a Jewish mother. You've got to do better than everybody else. And that's where she found out, the beginning, that she was a second-class citizen. And that's the key phrase, second-class citizen. That's what Jews live like in Russia. And I don't know if you remember, but a few months ago, there was that hijacking trial. You know what that hijacking business was? Some Russian people told Jews that they could get out of the country if they wanted to. They said, go down to this airport, and we'll get you a plane, and we'll get you out. So what the hell do you think the Jews did? They couldn't wait to leave, and they go down to the airport, and the stupid Russians are standing there, they arrest them, and they say, you're trying to hijack a plane, and you're illegally trying to leave Russia without an exit visa, so we're going to try you, and we're going to try you, and murder you. But the Jews of the world made a little bit of noise, and the lovely Pope stood up, and he finally said something, so they didn't get the death sentence. You know what they got instead, team? They got 15 years hard labor. They got 15 years hard labor with half of the normal dietary rations. And that's what's happening to Jews in Russia today. And you're sitting here, and that's what's happening to them. But it's more than that, too. It's not just in Russia. It doesn't end there. It goes on in Romania. The only difference is I've seen it in Romania. I was in Romania also. When I talk about a turning point of my life, I mean Romania was it, man. Like, I left Trenton for the first time that year. The first time I ever left this country or the state. And I went to Romania, and that turned my whole life around. I'm a different person now. Because the Jews in Romania live the same way as they do in Russia. And because the day that I left Russia to Romania, I had an experience, I'm telling you, I can't forget it. A chick the same age as me, 18 years old, I'm leaving, I go to say goodbye, and she starts crying. And she starts begging me. She says, get me out of my country, I want to leave. Now you think about it. Here I am, Mitchell Gold, standing over in Bucharest, Romania, all of 18 years old, a little pusher from Trenton, and this chick's asking me to get her out of her country. Now what the hell would you do? And I stood there, and I had no answer. I said, yeah, I'll try. I'll do everything I can. And this is a girl that asked me to get her out of her country. And Jews want to leave these countries. But you want to know something? There's 100,000 Jews in Romania today. A deal was made last spring to buy 40,000 of those Jews out for $35 million. That's the name of the game. That's how Jews play in this world. If you want a Jew to have freedom, you pay for it. So we're paying $35 million for 40,000 Jews. Believe me, you're never going to read that anywhere. You'll never read it anywhere. It's classified information. We know it, but nobody else does. Believe me. And that's what we're doing for our Jews. Because if we don't do it, nobody else is going to lift a finger. You think the United States government's going to lift a finger to buy a Jew out of Romania? Forget it. If your parents and if we don't do it, it just ain't going to get done. It's as simple as that. And the same thing goes on in Morocco. The Jews can't wait to leave Morocco. We have a lovely little deal there with the king. When the king's there, we pay $100 a head. Direct. Right to the king, give him $100, let's Jews out. When the king goes away on vacation for a month, we don't get Jews out for a month. It's as easy as that. But I'm telling you, we're taking them out, but where are we putting them? And that brings me to what I really want you to understand, and that's Israel. That's this little Cossack country 6,000 miles away, which we don't even, you know, so many of us don't understand what it's all about. It's a little country surrounded by three or four Arab nations that are trying to annihilate it, trying to wipe it right off the map. We're not going to let it happen, man. We finished that, I told you. We're not meek anymore. We're very strong people. But you do it with money. They've got to pay a lot of money for their weapons. And they're doing it. They won a war in 67. And they're going to win another war if it happens again. Because in 6 days, that ceasefire is up. In 6 days, there might be another war in Israel. I pray there isn't. I'm not a praying person. I'm not a sentimental person. Every night I go to sleep, I pray that there's not going to be another war there. Because the next war is not going to be like the last war. We'll win again, sure. I know we'll win again. But we're going to lose a lot more lives. And Israel doesn't like that. They don't like to lose their own children. They don't like to lose the Arab children. So in order to get away from that little war game, in order to win it, Israel has to spend 83% of its budget on defense needs. Now, I don't know if you can relate to that. But 83% of a budget to spend on defense, as compared with the United States spending about 35 or 40% of its budget on war games, you know, like the United States is in Cambodia and Laos and all over there running around. They only spend 35% of their money on war. But Israel has to spend 83% of its money on war. And that means that there's no money left for the social needs of the country. And the social needs of the country include bringing new immigrants into the country. It means bringing Jews out of Russia, out of Poland, out of Czechoslovakia, out of Yugoslavia, out of Muslim countries that are all over. And bring them there and settle them. But when we get them there, we don't forget them. We get them an apartment. We have a law in Israel. Once a Jew steps foot on that land, they're a citizen if they want to be. And when they're a citizen of that country, we don't care whether they're old, whether they're young, whether they're sick, whether they're healthy or what. No country in the world has a quota system like that. No quotas on Jews, on anybody. But you can be sick, you can be anything. We'll take care of you. They come 85 years old, 9 years old to Israel. And we take them in. We give medical assistance, we put them in an old age home if that's what's needed. We teach them, we give them pocket money, we get them an apartment, we treat them like people, like first-class citizens. That's what it's all about. That's what Israel is all about. Because with Israel, we don't have them anymore. We don't have to. We live as first-class citizens. And I'll just tell you one other experience that really made it for me. I stood at Lod Airport one night outside of Tel Aviv, the international airport, as a plane load of 90 Russian and Polish Jews came into that country for the first time. The day before, a couple days before, they were in Russia and Poland, living an oppressed life, and that night, 3 o'clock in the morning, 90 of these people came in. And it was the most beautiful sight of my life. I mean, I've never seen anything so beautiful. These people come in, and they start crying, and laughing, and kissing the ground. That's an 86-year-old man, a cat from Russia, kissing the ground, dancing all around. He couldn't be happier. He was free again, finally. And you see the mother standing there with the children in their arms, crying, because they know finally their children's going to live in freedom. And for God's sake, it's the most beautiful thing around. And we've got it. But we don't have it unless American Jews and world Jews cough up some bread this year. Plenty of it. National UJA, we're running a $400 million campaign to keep Israel alive. I'm running all around the country constantly, talking to students, talking to adults. In the last 4 days, I've been in 3 cities. I'm moving my ass from it, but I want to do it. I want to do it because Israel's going to live. And that's what you've got to do. There's not one person in this room that can't get $3, $4, $5, $10, $18, $20. You can give it, you give it, because you're saving lives. You can become a member of a very, very special club. You can go to sleep at night thinking a hell of a lot better. And I'll just close with one remark. This Russian girl that I met her, and then she went into a group of UJA people in New York, some very, very wealthy people, people that were giving hundreds of thousands of dollars each. And she just sat down, very nicely and quietly, and she said, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for getting me out of my country. I want to thank you for bringing me to Israel. I want to thank you for the food, for the clothing, for the shelter. I want to thank you. And that is something to believe in. In this country, our parents have this nasty habit. The adult establishment, in quotes, has this very nasty habit of falling for shit like this. It's baloney, man. This is what, you know, what the adults, is how they advertise. They advertise something to believe in, a brand new Buick, buy a new Buick, something to believe in. It's not for us. We're very idealistic kids, and we're going to put our stuff together, and we're going to save lives, because that's something to believe in. Thank you.